I can't seem to say goodbye.
Welcome, proud members of the present, to another episode of the Primalosophy Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Quarterbaum, and this episode is brought to you by UFF, the Firefighter Wellness Program on a mission to make the best job in the world a healthier one. Go to primalosophy.com/UFF to get started.
Kate Lever is a journalist, editor, and author of Good Dog, Celebrating the Dogs Who Change and Sometimes Even Save Our Lives. She researches, writes, and speaks about her dog, Bert, and the health benefits of having a pet. Her first book, The Friendship Cure, was about connection and loneliness. She previously worked as a senior editor for Cosmo. Her work has been published by The Guardian, British Vogue, Glamour Magazine, The Telegraph, and The Independent. She also works in editorial strategy and media relations for brands like Bumble, Peanut, and Snapchat. Kate, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So what made you want to write about the extraordinary bond between humans and dogs?
In one sentence, my dog is so cute, I wanted everyone to know about it. But probably more deeply than that, I had written my first book, which was about friendship and the loneliness epidemic. And I was brainstorming ideas for my second book. And my partner said to me, well, it had better be something you really care about and something that you are willing to speak about and write about for a long time after the book is published, because that happened with the last book. And I kind of jokingly gestured towards our beautiful dog, a nearly four-year-old Shih Tzu called Bert, and said, well, I don't care about anything more than I care about my dog. What if I wrote a book about him? And then I realized that I wasn't entirely joking and that actually there might be something in that. And the more I thought about the effect he had had on my life, the more I suspected, and I was right as it turned out, that there would be other extraordinary stories of a dog supporting human beings through pain, and whether that's, you know, emotional or physical health problems. I knew the extraordinary effect dogs, and particularly Bert, had on my mental health, and so I just started to look into it a bit more. And being a journalist by trade, it just got me, you know, researching things, asking questions, looking for other wonderful examples of what I would say is the most extraordinary cross-species friendship on the planet, which is between dogs and people. And I know I will preempt objections from cat people. I'm allergic to them, so I don't know their great charm. I'm sure they can be equally wonderful. But for me, it's always been about dogs. So that's really where it started, just an overwhelming love for my own dog. And then the sort of natural or perhaps professional inclination to look further into the issue and the relationship and the effect that these sweet creatures can have on our lives.
Is it true that we have archaeological evidence of burials dating back 14,000 years ago of dogs and humans living together and even eating the same foods?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting. I mean, as with just about any area of historical research, there are all sorts of experts around the world who squabble and disagree about the exact specifics. I mean, I think to the extent that we're not actually sure, I think there's arguable proof of a relationship with dogs, judging by archaeological evidence and stuff, anywhere from between like 9,000 and 60,000 years ago, depending on who you ask. So, you know, my conclusion is just, it's been a really, really long time. It's a very enduring friendship between dogs and people. And we think perhaps that it started out as more of a strategic relationship between wolves, and that basically over very, very many years, a deeper bond developed between dogs, well, between wolves and then, you know, their descendants, more dog-type creatures, and human beings. And perhaps one day, many, many, many years ago, they helped people guard their places of living, go hunting, share food, all that sort of thing, and then over a very long time, that changed. And of course, they became more sentimental connections. Although, having said that, there is plenty of evidence of dogs being buried in the same place as people. And considering if you look at those societies and the way they valued the afterlife and the burial process and the kind of sanctity of that, that suggests to historians that dogs have been really important sentimentally as well for a really long time, and perhaps even treated as members of the family, which I think is really interesting and beautiful.
What's the difference between survival of the fittest and survival of the cutest? And why do you think some people prefer the really cute dogs and others prefer the really badass, intimidating dogs?
I mean, it's such a good question. I feel like there needs to be a BuzzFeed quiz on this topic. You know, what does your favorite breed of dog say about you as a person? In fact, there probably is already. We talk a lot when we think about evolution and the way that the human species have survived over many years about the survival of the fittest, because life for many years was very dangerous. It still is, but for many, many different reasons. And so I think survival of the cutest is more a phrase I use in the book and that a lot of canine historians have used as well. To talk about the fact that we actually think dogs evolved to be cuter, such as learning behaviors like widening their eyes when they're looking up at human beings, twitching their noses, wagging their tails. They even physically evolved more quote unquote cute physical features like floppy ears and waggy tails, fur, all that sort of stuff. Well, fur they have for other reasons, obviously, but the softness of them and the overall cuteness of them, or what we perceive to be cute, has helped them stay around longer, arguably, because when a human being basically has their sort of a nurturing instinct triggered by something small and I won't say defenseless, because most dogs, well, my dog is probably defenseless in the wild, but you know, earlier primitive dogs were not. But cute things are things that we want to protect as people. And so it sort of did become a story of survival of the cutest, because these creatures actually adapt to be as adorable as possible to enhance their chances of being protected and nurtured and cared for by human beings. Now, the second part of your question as to why certain human beings find certain breeds of dog, you know, more appealing based on whether they go for cuteness or fierceness or, you know, whatever. I mean, that's such a good question and I would love to look more into it. I wrote an absolutely ridiculous Instagram caption the other day for, I think it was a National Rescue Dog Week or something over here in the UK. And I wrote a sentimental caption about my dog because we got him from a rescue shelter several years ago. And I said something like, you know, on our morning walk this morning, I was looking at my dog and thinking that maybe I do believe in soulmates, but not so much in the romantic human sense, more in the sense that perhaps we are all destined to find a creature or a thing that we find cutest in the world. And for me, that is a scraggly rescue, definitely not pedigree Shih Tzu. And I don't know what it is about them, but I had a previous Shih Tzu back in Australia in a different relationship called Lady Fluffington, and now I have Bert. And the Shih Tzu is just like the ultimate embodiment of cuteness to me, and I don't know what that is. I don't know why. But then there are other people who think that my dog is, you know, a glorified teddy bear, and they'd much rather, you know, have these gorgeous, fierce staffies on the end of a lead, or any number of other much more ferocious dogs. And I can't really explain that. I wonder if it is something to do with a mirroring of our own characteristics, perhaps even how we wish to be seen or what we find appealing in other creatures. I would say that, like, my favorite things about Bert are that he's affectionate and gentle and sweet and funny and cuddly. And I, you know, like, I'll be honest, those are the same traits that really appeal to me in human beings, be that, you know, a romantic partner or a close friend. I really value kindness and softness and vulnerability. So perhaps I'm, you know, either perceiving or projecting that onto the small creature that I've invited into my home and into my heart and into my life. And perhaps, you know, I can't speak for people who opt for really fierce dogs, because I just never would. It's not my vibe. But perhaps they you know, sort of are attracted to a toughness and a strength and a power. And those are their preferred traits in themselves or other people or other creatures, and therefore their pet of choice. I don't know. I'm just freeballing here.
Yeah, well, it does make sense. It translates. Some women want a really sweet man, but then at the same time, they want him to be able to turn it on and become fierce if need be.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, maybe also we seek out things from dogs that we don't get in other places, although I will say that my partner is also very sweet and affectionate and cuddly. So, I mean, I think probably it's a case-by-case thing, because I imagine perhaps someone might be attracted to a tougher or more ferocious dog if they felt that they needed that protection and if they felt vulnerable themselves. So it is difficult. I think it's a really interesting question, actually, that I haven't thought too much about, mainly because I just sort of concluded to myself that Shih Tzus were the cutest end of story. But there's an interesting psychological angle here.
And doing your research on emotional support animals, can you share some of the various emotional support animals out there that most people wouldn't expect to serve that role?
Yeah, so I actually, when I started out researching for this book, I was going to do it about emotional support animals, because it was a number of years ago, and there were a few stories, if you remember, actually out of America, of people taking emotional support animals on planes. And they weren't dogs. There was an emotional support peacock. There was an emotional support goose. I think there was an emotional support hog. And I just became really interested in this idea of what would qualify as an emotional support animal. And, you know, the more I looked into it, the less I wanted to talk about those other exotic creatures, and the more I just became obsessed with the dog subject. And I think there's enough material in the idea of what constitutes an emotional support dog. There are actually different rules all over the world. America, I will say, where you are, America is really forward thinking with the way they allow dogs into people's lives, like on public transport, particularly on planes, but also, you know, there are emotional support dogs in courts of law across America. You know, don't ask me to say how it varies state to state, but in various parts of America, for example, and this is a really good example of one that you might not think of, but there are specially trained emotional support dogs who can accompany victims or witnesses of crimes into the courtroom when they go in to testify. Now, I spoke to some people who own dogs who do that in Sydney and other parts of Australia and where I'm from, and they're actually not allowed in the courtroom. They're allowed in the kind of witness and victim support area, kind of a waiting room for the people who are going in to the courtroom. But in America, they're actually allowed to accompany people into the witness stand, which I think is so wonderful. And it sounds, I think some people find it controversial, because it's like, you know, the dogs, don't bring them into a place of very serious business. You know, the greatest venue of justice that we have is the courtroom. But in researching the book, I found a couple of really beautiful, really moving stories. You know, for instance, just some young girls who were, I think, around 10 or 11, and they had to testify that their father had abused them, which is, you know, one of the worst possible things a young person could ever be asked to do. And we have plenty of evidence that having to testify to something that traumatizing actually has the potential to re-traumatize a victim of that sort of crime, having to go over the details and their experience. But for whatever reason, these two girls, sisters, were offered the support of a dog in the courtroom. And essentially, they wouldn't have been able to testify without the company and the comfort and the solace of that animal standing next to them in the witness box. And I think that's a really lovely example, because I can understand, you know, unfortunately in my life, I've been close to people who have been through some really horrific things that people should never have to find the courage and resilience to survive. And I just think I truly think it would have made a difference in those moments where someone has to find the strength within them to go over the worst experience or the worst hour or the worst day of their lives. And I think it just would be really lovely if they needed it to have the extra comfort of an animal beside them. So that's probably my favorite example. But, you know, on the flip side, if we're going to talk about justice, I also went to visit a beautiful dog called Jingles in a medium security jail in Northern Ireland. Which is really interesting because I met a young man called Barry who was in jail for charges of arson. There are questions really about whether he deserves to be in a sort of mainstream jail because he struggles very much with autism and anxiety and is the sort of vulnerable person who's not being protected by the system that, you know, and when I say the system, I mean the judiciary system, but also the foster system, because he basically came out of a very sad childhood and straight into a life of crime. And the only thing that has stopped him, well, that has started him thinking about a different future, a future of living a sort of cleaner, safer life where he doesn't come back to jail, is the presence of this dog called Jingles, who he's allowed to walk through the prison grounds, which gets him out of his cell, and he is allowed to make appointments to see. And basically he hurts himself a lot, this young man, like a lot of prisoners do, or a lot of distressed people do. And he doesn't hurt himself on the days he knows he's going to see Jingles the Labrador. And that is just another example of, I think, you know, because it's a whole other topic to talk about whether people who've done awful things in life are deserving of love and affection during what is essentially a period of punishment for crime. But I think it comes down to how you think about justice and redemption and fairness and humanity, because there's heaps of really convincing, really interesting evidence that says that people in prisoners who are given the responsibility of looking after a dog, or sometimes even training them and teaching them tricks in their cell, they have lower levels of recidivism, which is basically reoffending rates. So if you think about the idea that definitely like the really the biggest objective of putting someone in jail is hoping that they don't hurt another person ever, or, you know, simplistically do a bad thing. And so really interestingly, and I was shocked by this, I wasn't expecting it, but like some of the most effective ways of trying to ensure that and give someone a chance at living a better life when they leave prison is giving them the company of a dog, which is just like astounding.
Dogs and books are both a man's best friend. If they're allowed to have books, why can't they have dogs?
Yeah, quite right.
What sort of training does Jingles have or an emotional support dog have that just your typical good dog doesn't?
Good question. So a lot of therapy dogs and emotional support dogs are often Labradors and Golden Retrievers, particularly if they're going to work with someone who has autism or is in a vulnerable situation or it needs to behave in a formal or corporate situation, like you wouldn't describe a jail as corporate, but, you know, like a serious environment. They're often Labradors and Golden Retrievers just because they seem to be the most reliably well-behaved and intelligent and easy to train breed. Having said that, you can actually train a Chihuahua if you want, or a Border Terrier, or anyone, you know, any dog is conceivably, theoretically able to be trained. Having said that, like for instance, even in the, you know, the top tier of trainable dogs, Golden Retrievers, when they're going through guide dog school, a lot of them are dropouts because they sort of, you know, get too enthusiastic or don't take the job too seriously enough. So the training is different depending on what the job, quote unquote, the dog is preparing for. So for instance, with a guide dog training, it's really rigorous. there are all sorts of different stages that it has to pass, qualifications it has to get, and it lives with a family who is training the puppy, all that sort of thing. With a mental health support dog in the UK, again, don't ask me to remember all the different ways this differs throughout all the different countries in the world, because I haven't retained that information. But in the UK, for instance, a mental health support dog, so someone, an animal that is allowed to accompany a person basically anywhere, so into supermarkets, shops, on buses, trains, anywhere they want, and wears a little jacket to signify that they're allowed anywhere, they have to prove, they have to pass a test by being able to prove that they do three things to improve that person's life, three necessary things. So there's a dog, I was going to say a dog I interviewed, a woman I interviewed about her dog in the book. The dog is called Sir Jack Spraticus, and the woman is called Vanessa Holbro, and she is a dear friend of mine now, having met her for the book. But she deals with some pretty full-on mental health problems, and she trained her darling dog Jack to do three things. So he can fetch the landline phone in the case of an emergency or if she needs it, which is really helpful, obviously, if she's in any physical danger. He can find and bring her medication, which is extraordinary, and he can do it from anywhere in the house. I've seen it. She says the command green, because she keeps her medication in a green bag, and she can leave it anywhere in the house. Like if she's carrying it around and she accidentally leaves it in the bathroom as opposed to its normal spot next to the bed or whatever, Jack will smell it, find it, locate it, bring it to her. And also he is able to calm her during a panic attack. And that usually means standing between her legs or if she is horizontal, lying across her chest. She basically had to train him to do those things and then prove that those things could improve her life in any situation. And now he's allowed to go wherever she goes. So that's a mental health support dog. Otherwise, with therapy dogs, it's largely just about temperament and assessing whether they are suitable in character and in temperament for the job at hand. So, you know, there are dogs who work in emergency departments in hospitals, in dementia wards, in old people's homes, retirement homes, all sorts of different situations. And essentially they have to pass another test, which is that they're not a nuisance or a danger to anyone. So they have to be good, really extra good boys and girls, ones who don't bark excessively or shrilly. Obviously they'd be ruled out if they bite or growl at people or display any sort of possessive or territorial behavior towards other people. They essentially just have to, pass a behavior test, really. Any dog can do that. But again, your calmer breeds, your more intelligent breeds are more likely to pass those tests.
And another story from your book, can you tell us about how Missy the pug helps Cody?
Ah, yes, I love Missy. I love when people ask me about Missy. So Cody is a young man. He was 11 when the book came out. I can't keep track of whether he'd be 12 yet. I don't think so. I think he's 11 years old. He lives just outside of London with his older brother and his parents. He is autistic, as is his older brother. He has had a really rough time growing up, to be honest. He has a lot of issues kind of controlling his emotions and his moods. He found it really difficult to go to school. He would get very angry, very distressed. Basically his autism diagnosis was making it difficult for him to live the happiest possible life, the life that he deserved. And a lot of people who have autism develop a particular specialty subject or an area that they become really interested in. And for Cody, that has always been pugs. He's always just sort of almost obsessively adored pugs. He has every type of pug paraphernalia you could think of: pug bed sheets, pug money box, pug t-shirts, pug everything. And so really, when he had a breakdown and he was very distressed and had been in hospital, and his mother had also been in hospital from the distress of looking after a child who is struggling, she realized that she needed to get in. This is Jill, Cody's mother, realized she needed to get Cody in touch with some real life pugs. So she organized for him to meet a bunch of pugs at a pug pub meetup, which is quite a tongue twister to say, but essentially a Facebook group organized for a lot of pug owners to meet at a pub on a particular day to just have a celebration of pugs. And Cody was the guest of honor, and basically he was just utterly transformed in the company of all these little nuggety creatures, and he became confident, sociable. He was able to speak to people, start conversations. He seemed to be comfortable in a public social scenario, which he's not usually. And so his mother just sort of realized she needed to get a pug in their household. So they got a 5-year-old deaf pug called Missy, who came from a rescue center called the Muffin Pug Rescue. And she is his autism support dog. So she essentially calms him down when he is distressed. And if he feels out of control or scared or upset in any way, he essentially just needs to touch and be with Missy. So if he gets down on all fours and strokes her and looks her in the eye and, you know, has a lovely snuggle, then that has the most remarkable effect on his mood. And, you know, I feel that I've known that effect so very personally and powerfully myself. And there's a lot of really lovely science on the reason that dogs calm people with autism. And it's really interesting. I write a lot about that in the book. There's a lot of proof that, you know, autistic kids benefit tremendously from the comfort of a dog. And that applies to just being able to function and go about their daily lives. But it also applies to things like going to therapy or going to medical appointments, which are usually, moments of stress and opportunities to become really anxious or scared. But having a dog, and in this case, having an adorable, lopsided, deaf pug can make all the difference. You know, I went to meet Cody and Jill and Missy sat on my lap, and she's one of those dogs who has her tongue perpetually stuck on one side out of her mouth. And I left their house completely covered in pug hair. And I wouldn't have changed it. I loved her. She was a sweet little angel. So, you know, that's the story of Missy and Cody. And I go into a lot more detail in the book and with some really lovely, really interesting studies on the effect that dogs can have on people with autism. And it's really quite extraordinary.
It is. And for you personally, how can your dog Bert tell when you are distressed or going through a depressive episode? And what sort of things does he do during these times that he doesn't do when you're just happy?
Yeah, so this is the first story I tell in the book, and really the reason I decided to write a book rather than perhaps just an article, you know, because I thought there was a lot in it. So I have dealt with depression my whole life. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder when I was a teenager. And then, you know, since then I've had various bouts of depression. And I discovered when I had a different dog back in Australia many years ago, Lady Fluffington, that she was a great comfort to me when I went through periods of sadness. And shortly after we got Bert, which was 3 years ago, I think, three and a bit years ago, I had a depressive episode, basically because I had to come off a particular antidepressant and go on a new one. And anyone who has been through that experience knows that it's deeply unpleasant. You have withdrawal symptoms from going off one medication and then possible side effects of going on to a new one. And it's all deeply unpleasant. And I was basically unable to function properly for a number of weeks. And I noticed during that time what an extraordinary effect Bert had on my ability to get through each day. Because he, I mean, you asked about what he does and how he knows I'm distressed. I mean, before I did research for this book, I just went around telling people that my dog was a genius who could smell depression. Because that was a theory that I had, because I thought, you know, I'd read how superior his nose and his sense of smell are. And I thought maybe there's some kind of chemical, some kind of pheromone that we create when we're in a state of distress. And after I spoke to various experts, vets, canine behavioral specialists around the world, they sort of suggested to me that that is not as ridiculous as it sounds. And perhaps Bert is capable, or dogs in general are capable of detecting on us an increase in cortisol, our stress hormone, or perhaps we exude some other kind of pheromone when we are in a state of distress, like we are when we are depressed. So that is a potential answer to your question of how Bert knows when I'm depressed. But I also think there's a marked difference in my behavior when I'm going through a depressive episode or even when I'm anxious. And, you know, depressive episodes, anyone who's been through depression will know this, which is, you know, at least one in four of us in the UK. They can last days, hours, weeks, months. And during that time, our body language changes, our ability to participate in our own life changes. So I think he probably notices the fact that I stay in bed a lot more. Perhaps, you know, my shoulders are rounded and I move more slowly. I think there's probably just a lack of energy, which for anyone who doesn't know what depression is like, is actually the defining characteristic, I think, of the experience of being clinically depressed. It's not so much an absence of happiness, it's an absence of vitality and energy. It's a listlessness and a sort of painful melancholy. But it's the loss of the ability to take interest in things and, as I say, participate in your own life that really defines that experience. And I think basically, you know, you give yourself away. I'm not very good at pretending things are okay when they're not. And I think Bert being my dog, can probably detect that change in me, whether it's a change in the way I address him, you know, if there's a little bit less excitement in my voice, whether I play a little bit less, or whether I just sort of move around a bit more clumsily and slowly. I think he can probably tell that. And you know, I'm a big believer in this. I'm sure not everyone would agree with me that dogs are more perceptive and emotionally intelligent and compassionate than we probably think they are. Well, not than I think they are. I think they're very much strong in all of those categories. But I think he basically recognizes that I'm struggling, and he does what he can to comfort me. Now, for him, that means usually if I'm lying in bed during the day, which is unusual for me unless I'm depressed or, you know, physically unwell, but that happens slightly less often, he will basically come by my side and refuse to leave. He's like a little pilot fish. He will either sort of lay himself down the length of my body and put his little snuffly nose on my shoulder, or in the nape of my neck, or interestingly, he will lay himself across my chest, which, if you remember from earlier when I mentioned the mental health support dog Jack and the woman Vanessa, that's actually what we often train therapy dogs and emotional support dogs to do when someone is in distress. We use positive reinforcement to train a dog to lie across someone's chest to help calm their nervous system and help them through a panic attack. So you could say dogs are the original weighted blanket. It's that effect of having a weight on you, and particularly on your chest, that can be really soothing. Bert does that instinctively. He does that on his own. I haven't trained him to do that. I do tell him he's a good boy when he does it, but the way I think of it is that he's just trying to do what he can to help, and what he's really, really talented at is snuggling. So he does that, and you know, like, it is enormously helpful to me. Having his little heartbeat against mine, having the warmth of his little snuffles and snores in my ear, and having his company during one of the loneliest experiences a person can have, and that is, you know, the feeling of wondering if they want to be alive anymore. You know, it's life-changing. It's like potentially life-saving. You know, his company has got me through some really difficult experiences, and I know I'm not the only one for whom that is true.
And one of the loneliest experiences people have had is lockdowns. But one upside of lockdowns was how many rescue dogs found their forever home. So in a way, all of these dogs were serving as emotional support animals during quarantine. And now that some lockdowns are being lifted, do you find your spirit being lifted as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good question. I feel so conflicted about the effect that lockdown had on dog ownership. Because it was so gorgeous. Like at the beginning, we saw so many rescue dogs find their forever homes, and that is really beautiful. But since various lockdowns have ended, I know we've been seeing over here in the UK, a lot of people decide that actually their dog was not for life, their dog was for lockdown. Mm-hmm. And apparently a lot of rescue centres have been overwhelmed by dogs being, well, rescue dogs being returned to shelters, but a whole other problem being created is dogs that were bought from breeders or pet shops and now being put in rescue centres now that lockdown has ended and people have the ability to, you know, go back to the office and resume a certain level of normality. So I'm really upset with those people. You know, there are apparently just I can't remember the figure, but just an astounding number of people who didn't think about the long-term safety and happiness of the animal they invited into their home. And that makes me quite upset. Obviously, I should also say that if you are in that position and you can no longer care for a dog, please, please, please take them to a rescue shelter, because that is the responsible and right thing to do. But yeah, I mean, that's possibly a little bit of a tangent and a little bit of a rant, because it just upsets me that people thought to themselves, I'd like some canine company. I've always wanted a dog. I'll get one during lockdown, and didn't think about the fact that they, you know, might not be able to offer them the same care and the same love and the same attention and safety, when life went back to normal. Not that it has yet. Having said, but the second part of your question was about whether my spirit has lifted. In London, we are just starting to be able to see other human beings inside buildings. We can now go into pubs and cafes and have people around, up to six people in our homes, which is really lovely. I'm half vaccinated. I'll get my second dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine early next month. So yeah, I mean, my spirit is lifting in a sense, and I think I probably credit Bert with a lot of that, because even on days now where I feel hopeless or helpless or scared or sad, you know, either because of depression or because of the normal experience of being a human being and surviving a global pandemic, sometimes when I feel like all hope is lost and I'm not sure where to look for comfort, I honestly look at this ridiculous, snuffly, stout, rotund little creature that I have beside me at most times. And I think, do you know what? If all else fails, I have the cutest dog in the world, and that makes everything okay. So he, you know, he has, if my spirit has lifted, it is partly to do with the easing of restrictions in our country, partly to do with being vaccinated, partly to do with being in a loving relationship with my boyfriend, and not insignificantly to do with the dog who lives with us.
Well, you've written a lot about loneliness being a modern health crisis. If we knew what loneliness was doing to our health, we would all freak out. So what's the first step we can take to stop being lonely?
Such a good question, and it's one I've thought a lot about. I think there is enormous strength and power in isolating and identifying an emotion. And I think a lot of times, you know, in clinical environments, in doctor's offices, loneliness is often misdiagnosed as depression. And I think we do the same thing. I think when we're feeling lonely, we often reach for and grasp for different justifications and different reasons. And I think you can only truly confront loneliness and treat loneliness if you acknowledge it. So I think the first step to reducing loneliness and to stepping outside of the loneliness you might feel in your life is to recognize what it is. And to, even if you don't say it out loud, you just have to know in your heart, I am lonely, and realize what it is, because otherwise you're going to try all sorts of different treatments. And it's kind of like, you know, putting a Band-Aid on for a headache. You're going to be treating the wrong ailment. So I think we have to get better at understanding loneliness and knowing that you don't have to be physically alone to feel lonely. Mm-hmm. You know, you can feel lonely in a relationship. You can feel lonely in an office. You can feel lonely in a crowded room or a wedding party. It's more to do with the gap between your expectations of social fulfillment and the social fulfillment you have. It's more an emotional and a psychological affliction than it is the state of being the only person in a room. You know, it's not the same thing as solitude. So recognizing what it is, understanding it, and then from there, I mean, my first book was called The Friendship Cure, to allude to the fact that, you know, there's a lot of really distressing science and evidence of what can go wrong in our bodies and in our minds and in our lives, and more broadly in our societies, when loneliness is a problem. But on the flip side, if we're going to be optimists about this, friendship has a lot of incredibly powerful curative qualities. So I'd say once you've acknowledged that loneliness is what you're dealing with, friendship is one of the most powerful tonics you can prescribe to yourself or to someone else in your life. And it's not necessarily about trying to collect the most Instagram followers. No, it's definitely not about trying to collect the most Instagram followers or Twitter followers, or sort of make the mistake of thinking that if you can write a really long invitation list for your next birthday party, then, you know, you can't possibly be lonely, because there are plenty of people in the world with huge followings and huge numbers of friends who are lonely in their own hearts and in the privacy of their own lives. It's more about trying to find true connection. So you could find that with one other person, one other dog, wink, wink, if you want to refer to my other book, or, you know, a handful of friends. It's not so much about the quantity, it's about the quality. And I think loneliness sits in the difference between those two things, the quality and the quantity of your friendships. So acknowledge it, recognize it, understand it, educate yourself about what loneliness is, and then try and find genuine social connection. And, you know, the biggest shortcut to finding social connection with another human being is to make yourself vulnerable to them. I don't think proper social connection really happens, or intimacy really happens between two people unless there's a level of vulnerability. And, you know, we've made the mistake culturally of painting vulnerability as some kind of sign of weakness, when in fact it is quite the opposite. Being vulnerable with another human being is one of the great gestures of strength and courage we have. And, you know, if you can truly properly find that with someone or multiple people or many people, then that is the sort of greatest chance we have of fighting loneliness that we have.
And just like our friendships with people, do we tend to forget the value of our friendships with dogs because it's always available?
Oh yeah, I think that's absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think one of the worst tricks that a really ever present love can play on you, when that's the love from a dog or love from a human being, is that it will always be there. And that's, you know, that's not true of anything, person, circumstance, object, whatever. So yeah, I think we do take our friendship with dogs for granted because they are just always there, and they have that unconditional love. Well, it's not entirely unconditional. It's slightly conditional on the, you know, the continuing appearance of food in their bowl and walks outside and all that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, I think the same is true of friends that we've had, human friends we've had for a really long time. I think you can make the mistake of thinking that someone is always there. And with friendships, human friendships and dog friendships, my big thing that I'm trying to get across with a lot of the things I speak about and write about is that they require investment and investment of energy and time and affection. And as I said before, vulnerability and intimacy. And I think, you know, we make the mistake as a society, at least a Western society, of treating romantic love as though it's the ultimate form of love. And I think we have come to terms with the fact that things like marriage and long-term monogamy take work. You know, they take work to make it survive over a long period of time. But I think we talk a little bit less about how much investment of time and energy and love friendships require, because they really do. They're not just ever-present, bubbling relationships that just survive for all time. And, you know, some friendships have expiration dates and some friendships are not forever, and that's fine. But I would argue if you cherish someone and if you love them, be that a person or a dog, you only really get out of that friendship as much as you're willing to put in. And we take them for granted so very much. And that can be, you know, at best a bit annoying, at worst quite dangerous, because it, you know, if someone's being neglected in a particular relationship, or even worse, abused or mistreated, that can be really a perilous situation. So I just, you know, I preach kindness, just like Harry Styles. You know, treat people with kindness, treat dogs with kindness, invest in your friendships, whether it's canine or otherwise. And that's really my big shtick, my big thing.
If we want to eradicate loneliness altogether, we must launch this aggressive campaign of kindness towards other people. So how do we overhaul the way we interact as a species?
Ooh, big question. Came here thinking we were just going to talk about how cute dogs are. Now I'm solving one of humanity's great questions. It sounds like a really difficult question, and in some ways it is. But in others, it's actually quite simple. And I think we forget sometimes that we have more agency than we know. And I think how we respond to situations and how we interact with other people is actually a choice. You know, every time we interact with someone, and whether that's casually, you know, on the bus or at the dog park, or at the supermarket or whatever, receiving a delivery from Amazon, or whether it's a deeper connection like a sibling or a romantic partner or a friend or a dog, we forget that we can actually choose how to interact with someone every time. And our lives are made up of all these tiny, tiny little mini decisions every day, hundreds of them. And we can actually, if we decide to, just be aware of what kind of vibe we're putting out into the world and just decide that we want to operate with more kindness. And that sounds like a sort of prosaic, vague thing to say, but actually if you just decide to do that and you go about your life, and sure, some of us have bad days and we can be grumpy and we can say things we don't mean, and we don't have to be sunshine all the time, and I certainly wouldn't endorse, you know, false jauntiness just to get by in the world, but I think you can just choose to be nice. You know, like, there are a couple of people I see at the park most days, several times a week, when I take Bert to the park every day, and I've developed little friendships with these people at the park. And actually for a really long time, I didn't even know their first names, but we would tell each other stuff. You know, I just told someone this morning, who owns Bert's best dog friend, about my mum having breast cancer. And we had a really beautiful chat about having to live in the present and not, kind of feeding anxiety by worrying about future outcomes of people we love. And it's like, that is a perfect example, because I have just decided to go to the park every day and be open and gentle and vulnerable with people. And I think we can do that. You know, that's a very specific dog park example, and I'm trying to, you know, bring both of my books and both the reasons you're talking to me into the one answer. But I think like, on a very small level, if all of us just went out into the world each time and chose kindness over all the other many, many options, then, you know, if we added that up to the actions, the sort of the quota of kindness on our street and then in our neighborhood and then in our city and our country and the world, you know, I guess that's the only way I can understand from my perspective, because I don't work in policy or, you know, politics or anything like that. That's the greatest sort of small example of putting kindness back into the world that I can think of. And I just think it's more of a choice than we realize.
I second that, Kate. We need dog park vibes throughout the world.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that quote, you know, be the person your dog thinks you are, because our dogs tend to think we are awesome, and they particularly respond to, you know, our best behavior when we are nurturing and sweet and affectionate, and when we're also responsible because we, you know, feed them and care for them and take them to the vet and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I would also say dog park vibes everywhere, and be the person your dog thinks you are.
All right, Kate, if you'd be so kind to share what's on your shelf, are you reading anything good right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes, I am. I'm reading two things because I like to have a fiction to start me off in the morning and a nonfiction for if I read during the day. I'm reading a nonfiction book called A Cure for Darkness by this science writer called Alex Riley. And it's a history of the way we treat depression. It's really interesting. It's a bit hard going, so I have to have breaks to read fiction. And I am reading a book called The Silence of the Girls by Pat Barker, which I think came out in 2019. And it's a retelling of a Greek story, kind of the Achilles Greek versus Troy situation, but told from the perspective of a woman who is usually a footnote in history, but or in the story. But is the focus of this story. So it's really lovely. So a bit of kind of feminist Greek myth retelling and a bit of the history of depression. And that is what is on my bedside table at the moment.
Thank you for sharing. And then last question, if you could have a drink with anyone in history, who would you choose and why?
Like, there's something about this question that makes me forget everyone who's ever lived. I actually Googled like cool people from history earlier because I was trying to think of who. I mean, if history also includes the present, it would be Harry Styles. But if we're just talking about people who are dead, do you know what? I was thinking, like, you know, how much of my answer to this question is like just showing off and trying to sound really cool, and how much is who I would actually enjoy having a drink with. And I have to say, I think it might be Jane Austen. Like, partly because she's a great writer, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, no, I was actually tossing up between Jane Austen and Nora Ephron. Partly, mostly the thing I think they would have in common is I think they'd be great. I think they'd have lots of gossip, strong opinions. I think we'd share a margarita and talk about, like, love, all the sex scenes that were edited out of Jane Austen's work, what Meg Ryan was really like on set with Nora Ephron. And literature and love and life and friendship. I don't know if either of them like dogs, but I'll run it by them. So I think I've cheated and said two, Nora Ephron, Jane Austen, but
and no. Harry Styles.
And Harry Styles, exactly. What a dinner party.
All right, Kate, if people want to find you, they can go to katelever.com. They can follow you on Twitter and Instagram at @KateILever. I'll have links to your books in the show notes below. Is there anywhere else that you want people to go to connect with you?
The dog park? No, just kidding. No, those are all the best places. And I always love to hear from people. My favorite thing about having written a book about dogs is when people send me pictures of their dog. So feel free to do that.
Awesome, Kate. Thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to follow me on social media at Primalosophy. And if you want to subscribe to my weekly newsletter, Sunday Goods, you can find the link in the show notes. Shakoba.